you even know the names of the trees in your backyard? Welcome to the Torg Stories podcast at thetorg.com, September 6th, 2016 edition. When I read that question about the trees, I knew I couldn't name much for certain beyond the evergreens. I came across it when I was in search of an Asheville area geologist who might be able to talk to me about the rock formations I've seen along the French Broad River. The question was asked by Brevard College's Jennifer Frick Rupert, a biologist and professor of environmental studies. Her question grabbed my attention and caused me to think about the 147 miles of water I'd passed through with my family on our recent French Broad River rafting trip. I got in touch with Jennifer, and she said she was willing to tell me about organisms that live in the water and their importance for the region. I learned a lot talking to Jennifer. Hope you enjoy our conversation. Thanks for listening. So Brevard is in a pretty, Brevard College is located in a pretty unique spot. Mm-hmm. Could you say more about what makes this a special place to be?
Sure. So Brevard College as a college, as an entity, we're only about 5 minutes from Pisgah National Forest. We're more like a half hour to 45 minutes from Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And both of these are areas that have been preserved because they have such a diversity of life present in them. So Great Smoky Mountains National Park is an international biosphere preserve that is on par with the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. But yet it's here where you can drive to it in half an hour and be out walking among this fantastic diversity of life. So many people don't realize that we have an area of incredible biodiversity just right outside our door. Millions of people are within a few hours drive of that park. The difference between the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and the Great Barrier Reef in Australia is that we don't have great white sharks cruising around. Most of our diversity is in the small things. And most of our diversity is also related to all the rainfall that we have here. We're out and looking around in space, trying to find out, not we, Brevard College, but we as humans are searching for water present in other worlds, because water is where you find life. And the more water you have, the more life you have. So all that rain, it's raining today in western North Carolina, and you've got to like rain here because we get a lot of it. But that's what supports all that diversity. That's what allows for all these different plants and animals and fungi and protists and bacteria to be present here is that water.
So I think at some point I read you say something about what plants are growing in your backyard. Mm-hmm. And my family just spent 150 miles on the river, and we don't know what's in that water, and we don't know what's on the banks, and I'm a complete layperson, as most of the people who see this film will be. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of awaken us to help us start to see and understand what's right there in the river?
Yeah, so when we focus on diversity here in this region, that it's the small things that are really diverse. Most people think about coming to the Great Smoky Mountains in the early summer and seeing these spectacular wildflowers. We do have spectacular wildflowers and incredible diversity. Many different species of trees and wildflowers in a single cove. Around here you can find a cove in a forest in the southern Appalachians may have 30 different tree species. Pretty easy to come across. You can go to Great Britain and the whole entire island doesn't have 30 species of trees on it. So we have that type of diversity of big things. We get black bear, we get river otters, many different species of fish, but we also have an incredible diversity of small things. So here in the southern Appalachians, our mushroom diversity, it's actually fungi, but the mushrooms are incredible. Some of the most diverse organisms anywhere. We have a diversity of snails. We have a diversity of millipedes. And in fact, we are the hotspot for salamander diversity. And if you'll notice, salamanders, mushrooms or fungi, millipedes, snails, all those things have water as a basis. Again, they're tied back to that high level of humidity, frequent rainfall that we have. So those are the sorts of things that you can get out and you have to search for them. It takes a little more effort to see a salamander or to find a snail. But that's where the diversity of organisms is.
So I think you sort of hinted at this idea of mutualism. Mm-hmm. And so can you tell us just about some of, I think you already hinted at There's a partnership between the fungi and the water. Mm-hmm. What kind of partnerships are important in the river, on its banks?
Right. One of my favorite ones, so this is just a favorite story of a mutualistic relationship. We have here in Western North Carolina some pitcher plants. They're called the mountain sweet pitcher plant. There's more than one species, but this one's Sarracenia jonesii. And it grows as a relatively tall, thin pitcher, which has a flap over the top. The way that pitcher plants work is that they form a tube and they attract insects. They release some sweet tasting and smelling chemicals around the rim. They attract insects, and the insects fall down into the pitcher plant and can't fly back up again. The insect dies, and the plant is able to utilize the nutrients that are in the insects. All animal bodies, because we're made up of so much protein, have a high level of nitrogen. And as that insect decomposes, it releases nitrogen. When you go to the hardware store and you buy a 10-10-10 fertilizer to put in your garden, the first of those tens is nitrogen. That's what plants require. So really what the pitcher plants are doing is that they found another source of nitrogen so that they're able to grow in an environment like a bog where there's not very much nitrogen being released. It's actually being bound up by the acidity of the bog. But the cool story that's about the mutualism is that in addition to these tall mountain sweet pitcher plants, there's another one that's called a purple pitcher plant. We have, again, a distinct subspecies that occurs here in these mountains. And this pitcher plant is rounder and open. It doesn't have a flap over the top, so it fills up with rainwater. It makes a little bowl. In that bowl, which is mostly rainwater and a few insects that get collected and die, it's the only place where you find midge larvae. Midges are like tiny mosquitoes, but they don't bite. Those midges come and lay their eggs in that particular pitcher plant, and there's one species of midge that goes to that species of pitcher plant. That's a great example of mutualism. One of those is not going to exist without the presence of the other one there. And that's also, I think, a good example of how the support of diversity actually increases more diversity. You can't have those midges present until you've got the pitcher plants, and you're not going to have the pitcher plants until you've got a habitat that's got a bog in it with usually sphagnum moss that's preventing the overgrowth of other kinds of plants. And all of those things link back together to the presence of a bog in Western North Carolina.
So I'm not aware of exactly what courses you teach, but I teach mm-hmm. some mandatory first-year writing courses, so it's always challenging. One of the challenges for me is, how do I get the students to care about this? So how do you get the students interested in learning more about something like that?
Right.
Or if the question is, you know, why should we care about this?
Mm-hmm. What I try to do with all of my classes, I teach biodiversity classes, I teach skills in sustainable living, I teach plants and animals of Southern Appalachians, and what I try to do with all my classes is get students out into the field. I just really think that you have to be connected with the natural world and to see some of these amazing animals and plants that we don't even realize inhabit the planet with us. And I find that to be exciting, and I try to communicate that same level of excitement to my students, because then we do get into questions like, why don't we just get rid of all the mosquitoes in the world? Mosquitoes bite humans, they cause disease, why don't we just get rid of them all? Well, it turns out here in Western North Carolina, we have several beautiful orchid species, tiny orchids like cranefly orchid, putty roots, another one. Those things are pollinated by mosquitoes. So if we didn't have mosquitoes, we wouldn't have these other species. Only the female mosquitoes bite. It's the male mosquitoes that are the pollinators, and they pollinate many different kinds of beautiful plants that we don't think about. They also become a main food source for birds. So if you want bluebirds, which are primarily insect-eating animals, birds, you need to have mosquitoes and deer flies and some of those other pesky things so that the bluebirds can feed on them.
You wrote that nature animates itself in cycles.
Mm-hmm.
So two cycles that I can sort of think of are night and day and, of course, the seasons.
Right. Yes.
What is there to think about when it comes to the river and cycles?
Yeah, I would say some of my favorite experiences in nature are are those that surprise you with their regularity. So I'm always impressed this time of year, in early September, we start to get migrations of nighthawks. And they're also sometimes called thunderbirds because they fly ahead of thunderstorms as they're on their migration, and you'll see these huge numbers of them. And I know that it's the time of year to get out and look for them. I love to think about that migration being one of the cycles that I consider, because it's a yearly phenomenon, getting out there and looking for that. On the river, I love to see those emergences of midges, again, those little tiny insects. You'll see them hatch out in a swarm, and then they are concentrated into a little ball, sort of like the bait balls you sometimes see on TV when you're looking at the planet ocean, Big Blue or some of those things. But this is in the air. Here are all these midges. They're swarming around in a tight ball, and you don't see them unless a beam of sunlight shoots through them. And then here is this dance of the midges. What they're actually doing is mating, of course, but it's this incredible dance that you see from these tiny little insects that you wouldn't even notice if you weren't sitting in a boat on the river. That's what it takes. You have to get out there to see it.
So you say this is the time of year to go out and look for those. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you at least think of me when you're going out to look for things. I would like to join you. I will drop everything and run out here.
All right.
And we can get out there and you can show us stuff. So I think one thing, I was fascinated by the different kinds of writing that you're doing. So mm-hmm. the cycles was from the idea of the cycles was from your book, Mountain Nature. Tell me about the rest of that title of that book. I know I'm missing the back half of the title.
That's
and then
okay.
Tell me about that project.
Right. So it's called Mountain Nature, a seasonal natural history of the Southern Appalachians. And that is really derived from, I started many years ago writing a regular column for the Transylvania Times, which is a local paper, because I would get questions from people about, there's this blue bird that showed up in my yard. It's blue all over, though, and it's at my bird feeder. Is that a bluebird? And the answer is actually no, it's an indigo bunting. Indigo buntings are only here in the summertime, and they always show up around Mother's Day. So that's when I would get those questions. That was the impetus for that initial book. I also
The columns that you're writing for the paper.
The columns that I was writing for the paper. I wanted to put those together. But it also grew out of my own teaching. I would find that I'd go out in the field and I would have along a book that was identifying wildflowers, and another one that identified butterflies, another one for birds, another one for trees. And I was loaded down in my backpack. And I thought the way people actually experience nature is they go out there and it's springtime. And in the spring, there are certain type of flowers that are blooming that you can predict. And they're different from the ones that are blooming in the summer and the fall. In the spring, you're going to look for those beautifully colored warblers that are coming through in the early spring. The fall warblers moving in the other direction are much more drab, so you don't see them as frequently and they aren't as spectacular. So if you're out at different times of year, you can expect to see different events. And that again made me start thinking about cycles in nature, where that description you read earlier came from about cycles in nature. I saw that on a regular basis.
That was really
the background for that whole book.
I have to limit myself because I'm also thinking about all the walks and talks that you did.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I will ask you about that a little. I mean, there must have been 35 walks and talks that you did. There's a whole list of them.
Yeah,
and was that related to the publication of that book, or that's something you did before?
That's something that I have done and continue to do. I got a lot of interest after the book came out and did a lot more of them during that period. I've been a little less good at keeping up on my website since then, but I still go out and do those.
So, and then the other two, that you, I think you, with your husband, went on a sailing trip, mm-hmm. and you wrote about that project. And I think what I'm interested in this more as a writer, mm-hmm. and as a teacher of writing, as someone who's not quite sure what this book is going to look like and how it's going to be put together,
mm-hmm.
because there can be kind of a memoir of like, I'm Bill and we're going off on the river and now meet some of these people, which is kind of how I see it. But if you know a book like Wilma Dykeman's, maybe,
right,
you know, that might be organized more thematically mm-hmm. according to subject. So tell me about that trip that you guys took, and did you end up putting the book together just like you thought, and how did you go about doing that?
Right. So I'm going to start by answering a little bit about Mountain Nature, because Mountain Nature gets categorized as being a field guide, and I guess it is a field guide, mm. but I tried to make it a field guide that told stories. So it's not the classic type of field guide where there are 1,000 gorgeous pictures of wildflowers. I tried to have some pictures of some unusual organisms in there so that there were things that people could see that I provided the pictures of that were perhaps a little more unusual. There's a picture of a bee swarm in there. There's a picture of a stinkhorn, you know, some different things like that to show people some of these weird things that are out there. And I wanted Mountain Nature to be more of a storybook, an engaging way to get people involved and encouraged to go outdoors and to see things in nature. And then to use some of those really good field guides to help them find out more about that.
Did you take a lot of those pictures?
I took all the pictures.
Wow. Yeah.
They're either mine or my husband's.
Uh-huh.
He's a good photographer too. So that was the initial idea behind that book. And then when it came to waterways...
You know, I wanted to say also about that book, I checked it out from the library, just because mm-hmm. you and I just made these plans to talk a few days ago.
Right.
Immensely readable. Yeah.
Thanks.
Didn't read at all like a field guide. Certainly really conversational tone. Mm-hmm. I look forward to reading more. Okay, so on to waterways.
Yeah. So my next book was called Waterways Sailing the Southeastern Coast. And as I said, my initial... exploration of biodiversity was actually coastal biodiversity. That was what I did my PhD on. So I had spent a lot of time at the coast, and my husband and I had a sailboat, and we would, again, it goes back to that experiential learning and the experiential learning cycle of just immersing yourself in the environment, exploring it, getting to understand it, and then taking time, stepping back away from that and reflecting on what it was you learned, and then going back into it again. And that's exactly what we did with our sailboat. As professors, he's a professor at Clemson University, also biologist. So you get two biologists together and we talk a lot of biology.
Yeah.
But we got involved in sailing because we would have those summer months free. And one of the best parts about being a college professor is that you get an opportunity in the summer to do something that's completely different, and it absolutely refreshes you and gets you ready to come back into the classroom like you probably
That's what's happening to me right now.
Absolutely. So we would go sail for several months down the coast. And while we were doing that, again, biodiversity is what we both enjoy. So we were learning about that diversity. We were curious about the birds and the fish and the little animals that live underneath the grains of sand on a beach. All of those different things interested us. But what we also became very curious about and learned from our reflective piece was how we changed ourselves over time because we were immersed in nature and wondering about our effects on nature, how we were changed by nature, how our experiences and our immersion again into that environment, it was philosophical about how you change and understand those things. So when it came, so I kept a journal while we were
sailing. That was
sailing.
My question, right?
And I would write in that pretty regularly, you know, not necessarily every day, but certainly kept it regularly about different things that we were experiencing and different things that we learned. And that's what I based my waterways book on. It's a narrative nonfiction, so I created a single journey in that book to tell the story so that it made sense and flowed. And the reality was, of course, we made several different journeys. We made that particular journey more than once, and mm-hmm. we made many shorter journeys that also got incorporated into that. So there was more of an attempt with that book to use some writing craft to create a narrative that held together and that showed how we changed over time.
Right. You know, my daughter, we do these progress update videos on what we've been doing, and she'll say, "Dad, the train blew its horn at us after we went under that bridge. Why is it before?"
Right.
You know, that
mm-hmm.
kind of question. So that's pretty interesting. Now, on the publication, did you talk to people about your project before, or did you just write the book and then try to find somebody to publish it?
On both of those examples, I wrote a book and then I found a publisher.
Yeah.
And both of those are with university presses. So Mountain Nature is with University of North Carolina Press, and Waterways is with University of Florida Press. And honestly, I really enjoy writing. I really enjoy teaching. I don't know a thing about publishing. So I just went straight to a university press in both of those examples. I do, however, have another book that's coming out, and it's now with a commercial publisher. It's called Amberjack Publishing, which is out west. And this book is called The Legend of Skyco. And it is my first attempt at fiction. It's historical fiction, and as you might guess, it has an awful lot of biodiversity in it. When I was working on waterways, learning about coastal biodiversity and natural history, I got very curious about how that had changed over time. And honestly, it all comes back to a fishing trip where I was out fishing and it took me forever to catch a fish. And I thought, this is crazy. Native Americans couldn't have been spending this much time fishing. They just starved to death, right? So surely there must have been more fish in the sea before today. And I got interested in that and did some historical research. And indeed, there were. There were bigger fish. They were, the environment has changed significantly. And while I still, you know, encourage people to get out there and enjoy where they're living and what they're seeing and appreciate biodiversity, it is significantly different than it was 500 years ago. As I began to research that, then you start talking about the fact that sturgeon were common. They were 13 feet long. They were in the rivers all over the place. In my whole life, I've seen one sturgeon. They're a federally endangered group. There's actually more than one species of sturgeon. So if sturgeon are gone and many of the longleaf pine ecosystem has significantly changed, what about all the human history that's also changed? That human diversity has also shifted. And that's what began to really interest me, and I got going on studying human diversity. Who were all the Native American people? We know here in Western North Carolina about the Cherokee, and one of the reasons that we know so much about them is because they actually persisted much longer as a functioning group, a functioning tribe of people. Whereas many of these coastal tribes, many of the Algonquin tribes along the coast, didn't persist, and we didn't write down much information about them. There are still native people, and there are still tribes, the Lumbee along the coast, the Sapana. There are different groups that are there, but we lost a lot of diversity too, and so I became curious about that. The Legend of Skyco is really my attempt to describe what it would have been like before Europeans arrived along the coast. And Skyco was a real boy. He was part of the Chowan River tribe, the Chowanawaks, and they encountered the first English explorers in 1585. Skyco was actually kidnapped by them. Ralph Lane was the leader of the English explorers then, and he was kidnapped because his father was the chief, and they wanted to be sure that they were going to get help from the Native American people. It turned out to be not so bad. Skyco was probably pretty well treated. He ended up being released by the English when they went back to America, and he helped the English, probably prevented them from being killed by some of the other tribes in the region.
How old is Skyco in the book? And maybe you don't have an exact age.
He's about 10 to 15.
Uh-huh.
And so the book is written for young adult, middle grade readers.
And it's not out yet.
I hope it's out by Christmas. I don't know that for sure.
Yeah. I have a 10-year-old, and I think she would love it. Yeah. What was the other? Oh, how did you find the press? How did you go about doing that? Because you said you don't know anything about publishing, but your books seem to be finding ways to get out.
Right. So I contacted a lot of different publishers, uh-huh. and just I'm sure you've heard before, you got to get used to rejection when you're a writer. And you have to connect with somebody who has, I think, the same vision as you. And that's not so easy in many cases. I really wanted to be sure that I had a publisher who wanted to have accuracy, who wanted to have biological realism, but that also was interested in trying to get this information out there about what life was like for the Native Americans here 500 years ago. The beauty of it, the magnificence of the region, what was lost by losing so many of those people who knew so many things. That to me is what drove me to write this book and to connect with young people.
It seems like a book that should be put in front of a lot of kids in Western North Carolina.
I sure hope so. Yeah. I want to get it out to libraries. And
it's interesting that you didn't, so you never tried, you didn't go the agent route. You went straight to the presses?
I tried a few agents too, right. I think agents are as hard to get as a press.
I think so. So. Yeah, I mean, my first novel was making the decision to skip the agents and just start writing editors at presses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's always interesting. I mean, there's so many different ways to end up finding a place to publish. So there was once a project, Dreams of Eden, right?
There still is a project.
Okay, I don't want to dig in your mm-hmm. personal life if you don't want to go there, but I think it's more about your family and where you mm-hmm. guys live and what you've been up to. Let's hear about that then. And
sure.
I sort of am a little bit... We live like on a half acre in Asheville, in South Asheville, And we certainly entertain the ideas of more space and a little bit of land. So this will be good. I can take it home to my wife and tell her what you said. Yeah, so tell us about that project.
I will. And I also want to just kind of give a shout out to that the Amberjack publisher that I found. The connection with them has been fantastic. It feels like I finally found someone who is interested in doing the same thing that I'm doing, and that's a wonderful feeling.
Absolutely.
But it takes an effort to get there, to get hooked up with the right publisher. But I'm pleased I did. So Dreams of Eden. Dreams of Eden is a book that is almost finished. I can't quite wrap it up. I think that's perhaps pretty common for writers that to find a good introduction and a good conclusion.
Especially when it's your life and it's still ongoing.
Right, exactly.
Where's the end?
Exactly. And Dreams of Eden is about the many years that my husband and I lived off the grid up in Balsam Grove. So Balsam Grove is... Brevard is not a big town, but Balsam Grove is even smaller, and it's up towards the Parkway, and it really is like living in Eden. It is just a gorgeous location in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of everywhere, however you want to say that. But for us, it was in the middle of nature. So we found a place where we could live in the forest. We built a small cabin, and what I loved about living there, I still miss it today. I live in a normal house now. But what I miss about living there was that the opportunity, we had our windows open all the time, of course, with screens on them, but you could hear what was happening. So I would hear screech owls going at night. I'd hear barred owls. If you got up in the middle of the night and stepped outside, you saw fireflies, or stars. You just were in nature. You couldn't escape from nature. We didn't have a television, which was wonderful because you got no distraction from that. We didn't have air conditioning, so we'd have our windows open. It was a wonderful experience. It was just gorgeous. And that's what the book is about, is telling the story of what we did. So I've got some very practical chapters about how do you go about laying out a cabin so that it's square. How do you put in piers to support the base? I've got some of those very practical chapters in there, but then I also have different chapters that focus, or halves of the chapter. So I'll describe an aspect like how do you get your own water? So what we did was we went to a spring head that was up the mountain. We drove a pipe into where the water actually emerged from the ground so that we were collecting the water below ground level so there's no way for animals to get into it. We ran a pipe down to the cabin and we had gravity feed water. Then we had a pipe that came out of the cabin and it went down to a hemlock tree, and that's how we watered the sink from that. The water from the sink came out and watered the hemlock tree.
Wow.
So we think about that, but then if you start thinking about if you're forced to consider, where does your water come from? Where does your waste go? How do you provide enough light? What if you need some electricity to generate so you can write on your computer? Where does your food come from? How do you keep your cabin warm? When you have to confront all those different aspects of being alive, you also think about what all those different things mean. And so that's what Dreams of Eden is about for me, is here's how we grew our food, and this is what it meant to grow our food for us. This is what we thought about as we were doing these many different tasks. So I feel like I've set the book up the way I want to set it up. I've got an introduction that I like that describes our place in nature and our place in the world and how we went about connecting to that place and building there. But I haven't come to that conclusion that I really want to pull it all together yet. But it's getting close, and I need maybe another summer to finish it.
What drew you out of that lifestyle? Because you're not there anymore.
Having a child.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to blame him. He's wonderful.
No,
I'm
course.
Very glad to have had a child. But it becomes more complicated. There's a lot more to it. When there are just two of you, it's two of you who are doing the same thing. You live in such a small place. It's actually a lot like living on a sailboat. When you're on a sailboat or you're living in a cabin that's in a remote location, you absolutely rely on each other, and your relationship either, I think, becomes closer or further apart. As you add more people into that relationship, it necessarily becomes wider and more complex. You have many more things to consider. You want to do what's best for your children and put them in a good location and make their lives as good as possible. And it takes many more, there are many more parts that have to feed into that to make it work. So as our son, we have one son, and as he, when he was a tiny baby, we remained in the cabin. And we were able to build a structure to keep him away from the wood stove. We're able to, you know, keep an eye on him. But once he got to the point where he was walking and moving around, mm-hmm. and we realized we wanted to be close to a school system, you know, all those different things that feed into that. What we ended up doing was we moved for a short time. We lived in a wonderful community called Sherwood Forest here in the Brevard area. And we loved that, but we missed our mountain land. And so what we ended up doing was we still have our cabin. We still live on the same land, but we built an energy efficient house on that land. And it has a washing machine, you know, which is a big deal when you've got a child. It has a connection to the internet, which becomes important when your kid goes to school. So we've got all this. We're connected now.
How old is your son? I only asked just thinking in relation to my kids.
He's 13.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my girls are 8 and 10. You have TV now.
We have TV now. Yep. Yeah. Enjoy watching international soccer, which makes us laugh. You know, that's we never saw that before, but we, you know, both of us enjoy.
Do you guys fish still?
We do fish, but we have ponds where we keep trout. And we have a big garden that we grow food in still. And
I'm
still
very envious of what you've set up. Mm-hmm. So this is a big change of subject, but the fish reminded me, and it might not be your area of expertise, but the water struck me as extremely clear and cold when mm-hmm. we got in at Rosman, and it changed. So just what does the water pick up between here in Asheville and here in Newport, Tennessee? And I'm mostly thinking about negative things. Mm-hmm. Sediment, sure. I guess I've heard a lot about.
The number one water pollutant we have in Western North Carolina is sediment. It's not nasty oil things that you would see a sheen or dirty water. It's sediment. And sediment is a problem because of the organisms that live here. So people come to Western North Carolina because they want to go trout fishing. The reason that trout occur in our streams is, number one, because the water is cold, and cold water can actually hold more oxygen than warm water can. So if you go down to the coast, the water is warmer. There are fish that are adapted to having that lower oxygen environment down there. But our trout, they require oxygenated cold water. So trout farms up here frequently have to pump oxygen into their water to keep those trout happy. That's what we've got naturally going on. So heat is a problem. If the water becomes warmer because we don't have hemlock trees, because rhododendrons have been cut back from the banks, and the water heats up, that's a negative. But sediment, as I said, number one pollutant, because what happens is the sediment gets into the streams, it directly clogs up the gills of the fish, but even more important is it clogs up all the crevices underneath the rocks in the river. And if you ever pick up a river rock and look underneath it, you'll see all these little insects scrambling on that surface. Those are trout food. They're mayflies, they're caddisflies, they're stoneflies. There are other kinds of insects too, but those are the big three that require clean, highly oxygenated water with space underneath those rocks to live. And the sediment clogs up that space so that you don't have all those different organisms living there. And if you don't have them, you don't have trout.
So what can people do? What can we do to reduce the sediment, some of the problems that you're talking about? What would you like to see happen? And I've been asking that question of several people.
Yep. We need buffers along stream banks. I know that's controversial, but it is absolutely important. And that's for several reasons. What a buffer along a stream bank, a buffer means a strip of vegetation along the stream bank that is not disturbed. That's providing shade to keep the water cool. It's providing a plant, it's strengthening the bank to prevent the bank from eroding in. Erosion is what's providing sediment. The wider the strip, then the more opportunity there is to catch sediment that's running off the land before it ever gets into the stream. Just the physical action of grass blades are going to catch the sediment before it ever gets to the stream. And it also catches one of the other pollutants that we have around here are nutrients. We don't have a lot of algae growing in our water because it has a very low nutrient level, and that's normal and good. When you get too much nutrient, fertilizer, even pollution runoff, that's going to cause algae growth, and the algae will clog up the stream again, as it dies, it also uses up oxygen. So it's all tied together. Sediment, oxygen, algae growth, nutrients, all those things play into each other.
And is that controversial because someone says, I own this land, I want to sit here on the edge of the bank, I don't want this shrubbery right. or rhododendron.
I want to cut it as, you know, I don't want rhododendrons there, I want it grassy right down to the edge.
I want manicured grass right on the edge.
Or I'm a farmer and the closer, you know, I want to plow my land up to the edge because every foot I grow more soybeans on, the more I'm going to make from that land.
And then do we just have to hope for the that the farmer or the homeowner decides they care about the earth, or is there a reason that they should care? Is it because their own bank is eroding? Would that be a reason to get them to care about it?
Their own bank is eroding, and what people are doing upstream of them affects them. So they don't think about what they're doing to people who are downstream of them, but we all live downstream. Somebody is upstream of us in every place. So we need to be considering how our actions are affecting the people who are downstream of us.
What do you know about, this is my last question because I know you have a few things you wanted to show us and we've taken a lot of your time, but what do you know about, are there trout raised in the area that are placed in the forks leading into the French Broad? Do you know about that or not?
Sure, Mm-hmm. There are a lot of trout. We, right here in Pisgah National Forest, as you go up 276 out of Brevard, there is the Pisgah Center for Wildlife Education, which everybody around here calls the fish hatchery.
Right.
Because that's what they do. They raise trout. Mm-hmm. And they release those trout into streams around here. So there are trout that are being raised and released. There are also other areas. We have muskellunge, the big fish that you're going to have a picture of a little later. Those are raised and released in that, not necessarily at that particular hatchery, mm-hmm. but those are reintroductions. There are sturgeon that have been, lake sturgeon that have been released in some of these areas. I'm not sure exactly where they have been released, but they've been raised and released. And river otters are another introduction. They were taken from eastern North Carolina and reintroduced and have just done very well because our water is so much cleaner than it was when Wilma Dykeman was writing about our water. When she wrote her book about the French Broad, one of the chapters in there was called Who Killed the French Broad? And the French Broad was so polluted in the 1950s. What I find really interesting and hopeful about that is that when she was writing that book and the French Broad was so polluted that it couldn't support trout and it couldn't support river otters, there were only 22 point sources of discharge. By that, I mean a pipe. There were 22 pipes between Brevard and Asheville that were discharging into the river, and they made the river polluted enough that it was not useful. We now have, in that same stretch of river, over 200 point sources of discharge. But what we've done is we've regulated what can come out of a pipe. By regulating what's come out of a pipe, we now have a river that's so clean that these reintroductions are doing very well. But not only that, we have 10 times the number of users of the river. So the economics of the river have also expanded. So I think that's a great example of where environmental concerns actually support economic development. And the two things are working together. We've got cleaner water, we've got people who are coming to the area to fish now, and we have an environment that's better too. And so it worked to pull all that together. And I would hope that people would see that in many cases, environmental regulations are beneficial at different levels. They're beneficial for the environment, sure, but hey, you know what? They're also really good for the economy of the region.
Hey guys, that's it for my conversation with Jennifer Frick Rupert of Brevard College. We went on to look at some sample fish and she pulled some organisms out of solution. And so you can see that in our forthcoming film about the French Broad River. You can see more updates about this project at thetorg.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good week.
I'm going to take out Diane Court.
Diane Court doesn't go out. She's a brain
trapped in the body of a game show hostess.
If you're just going to let him drive by, if the rest of you are going to let him catch the ball outside the 3-second lane and drive all the way in here without one guy challenging him.
Those aren't pillows.
But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain and an athlete.
And a basket case. A princess.
And a criminal. Does that answer your question?
What would you little maniacs like to do first?